everyone. Welcome all of you to Nikki Lal Creative Presents with Industry Leaders, where today I'm joined by special guest Lydia Pang, who's currently Global Creative Director at Nike. So welcome, Lydia. Thank you so much for joining us today. Do you mind just quickly giving us an intro about yourself?
Yeah. Hi, guys. It's nice to be here. I have a cup of tea. It's 8 a.m., so bear with me. So I am a creative at Nike. I work on NSW, ACG, and influencer marketing, which is all of our collaborations, based in Portland, Oregon, which is where I am now. Before that, I've had a whole, like, my career has kind of shown, like, the higgledy-piggledy of the industry. So I kind of describe myself as this like Frankenstein creative. I'm not exceptionally good at anything, and I've learned to embrace that as my kind of superpower. So over the years, I've had all sorts of jobs. I've been, I've worked at Anomaly. I've worked in agencies. I've worked at M&C Saatchi. I was the creative director at Refinery 29 in New York. So yeah, my career is very much like a map of the changing industry and my kind of like hybrid creative identity.
First question I have for you is, at what point in your life did you decide that you wanted to become a creative?
That's interesting, actually, because I feel like even though I grew up in Wales, I don't know if you can hopefully still tell by my accent that I'm Welsh. I hope so. But I grew up in Wales and I had a very creative family. Like, my mum is a gallery owner and a curator and a photographer. My dad, although he doesn't work in the creative industry, he's an engineer. He's a very creative person, an amazing like painter and thinker. And so I was always around very creative people, despite Wales not necessarily being the most creative place, or at least where I grew up. And so I feel like there was never much of an option. I don't remember there being a discussion about that. I just remember gravitating, you know, my parents would always say, just gravitate towards the things that make you feel good, that give you energy, that make you feel happy when you do them. And those things happen to always be creative writing. And it wasn't really ever like drawing or painting. I wasn't that kind of creative. Again, I was always like a bit of a complex being. I had a lot of ideas about creative. I loved discussing them and debating them with my parents and my sister. And so, yeah, I feel like being creative was always just like the path. And my parents very much encouraged me to like follow whatever made me feel good. And it happened to be discussing creative, not necessarily making it, which I suppose we'll get to, but that's like the complexity of my creative role. I think a lot of people spend many years crafting, working in a specific craft, and I have a lot of respect for those people, but I just wasn't one of those. And I struggled with that over the years, thinking I wasn't really, really good at one thing. But now that's kind of why I get hired, because I have an opinion on lots of things.
Yeah. So how did you start climbing the career ladder after graduating? Because I heard one of your first internships with M&C Saatchi, and they made a position for you at the company.
Yeah, so I studied history of art, which I loved, because it was like the perfect degree for me. It meant that I could spend all my time analyzing and discussing art and then unpacking all of the frameworks and the theory behind it. And that's, it's amazing, actually. I feel like I'm one of those people that actually uses their degree in their job. And I feel like not many people actually have that, but that was amazing for me. I loved it. I studied at the Courtauld. And then I did a art direction short course at St. Martin's, because I kind of felt like when I left my degree, I knew I wanted to stay in London and I needed the finances to be able to do that. And so, you know, I needed to find a way to make money from being creative. And I didn't know how to design or anything like that. And so I quickly was like trying to find a way to like commercialize all these opinions I had about the visual world. So I did art direction, which was good. A lot of people from my course went on to kind of like become transferred to law or like, you know, get super like fancy jobs in like fancy galleries. But I found those spaces, although beautiful spaces to visit, not what I wanted to do. I knew that I wanted to reach a lot of people. And I was always kind of like one of those people that would buy like, you know, I'd have like a Vogue subscription for my birthday and I'd look at the first like 25 pages of all those amazing ads and I'd guess who the photographer was for each one. And I didn't really care about the rest. I wasn't interested in reading any of that. So all to say, I knew I wanted to work for a big ad agency and I was like, right, who's the best? And I knew that M&C Saatchi was the best at the time. And they had this big fancy glass office in Golden Square. And I was like, that's where I'm going to work. Kind of cocky. I've always been a little bit like that, very like set my eyes on something and then I'm just like run towards it. which in my age is, I think, is a bit tiring now. I just had my birthday yesterday, so I'm feeling quite tired. But yeah, so the way that I approached MNC Saatchi is I knew that if I could just get in the door, I could evidence to whomever I interacted with that I was supposed to be there. So I applied for an internship as an account manager, which is laughable because I would be a terrible account manager. But I was just like, fuck it, let's just go for it. And I remember like showing up for the interview. I was feeling really ill that morning. I think it might have been nerves. My dad drove me up from Wales. And it was snowing, and I went in, and I, you know, I remember walking into that big glossy lobby, and there being lots of people there, and they were not like me, and I was like, shit, I've messed up here. Like, these people were like buttoned up, like the kind of people that have their resume printed really clean in one of those like lovely plastic folders, and they like hold it, and it's like really fresh. I was not that. I was like wearing like oversized, like, you know, suit, making like a comment about masquerading in a masculine space. I thought I was like really funny and witty. I had my like black lipstick on. I had this like suitcase which you opened, and I'd like made a washing line inside, and different objects personified my like skill set. So I was like quite random. I looked quite random, but I think it worked, because although that day was arguably one of the worst days for my like imposter syndrome, it was like, I just remember all day feeling sick and anxious and like very out of place. I evidenced through being bold and sticking and having conviction about what I liked and what I believed in, that I was supposed to be there, just not on that floor, on a different floor. And so it did, they did come, you know, send me an email saying, you did not get this position or this internship. To be honest, I was a bit like, phew, because I would be terrible at it. But then they did email me saying, look, you visibly belong in the creative department, so we're going to try and find you an internship there. And I just bugged them and bugged them for weeks, like, please, like, find me anything. Like, I just want to be in that space. And so I did then get an internship in the art buying department, which is a department which I don't know if necessarily exists so much anymore. It's kind of like a hybrid of the art director or the producer, but the person who like commissions the illustration and the photography and the direction. And so I was an intern in that department for about a year, learned a lot from the people who were running it. And then inevitably started to shape my own point of view on what we were doing. Again, very arrogant. I was just kind of like, oh, we're kind of partnering these photographers with these briefs, and we're making these like big billboards, but like I'm on like Facebook, and I met my husband on MySpace. I was like, I'm like all about this digital world. So like, how are we showing up for this digital world in this space? And MNC Saatchi is a big old patriarchal old school ad agency. And so I don't know. It was a weird space for me to be mouthy, but I was. And so yeah, eventually I just pitched to my CD that we should have a department that in some way encompasses this need for content. I didn't really know what that meant at the time, but that's inevitably what I did. And then I was the head of content within a couple of years. I think it was 2 years.
That's quite the journey. And I really like what you said about when you set your mind on something and then you race towards it. I think that's very important, especially at junior level. I'm always saying to people, find out where you want to go and identify where you want to go. And that's really important. What advice would you give to junior creatives starting out in their career at the moment?
I mean, at the moment, that's tough. Yeah. I mean, the one thing I will say is you have a lot of material to create interesting work from. I think my advice would be to identify like the three things that are like a priority to you in that role, be it like autonomy, location, a title, it might be pay. Like, identify that thing that's super important to you. Actually, I kind of do this every year. My mentor a few years ago was like, put in order what is important to you right now. And you have to be honest with yourself, otherwise it doesn't work. So you kind of are like, okay, well, at the moment it is money, or at the moment it is a title, or, you know, things we feel ashamed to say are important to us because we all want to be these like creative beings that change the world. But I think it's important to be realistic about what you need now to get you to where you want to go. And you can have that vision of, in 5 years, I want to be working at a mission-driven company. I want to be running a department. I want to be doing X, Y, and Z, or I want to be running my own studio. Those things are important. But then what are those steps now to get you there? So I was super strategic about that. I knew like, okay, I'm in content. That's great. I inevitably want to be in media. I wanted to work for like a big mission-driven media company. Okay, good to know. I need to then work for an agency that's going to facilitate that kind of work. Or if not, and this is paying the bills, that's fine. On the side and on the weekends, I need to be making that kind of work to fill my portfolio. So as long as you have that kind of like evergreen vision of where you really want to be, say in like 5 years, and it can be loose, don't be too hard on yourself, then you can work back from it in a really methodical way of being like, okay, well, what's going to get me there? Well, I need this job now. I need to pay the bills. Like, I had no option. I had to get a job to stay in London. And so once you have that, then you can think about what are the steps that need to get you to that place. Hopefully that makes sense. That's how I do it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that's advice I give to a lot of creatives is, just because you haven't had a chance to work on certain projects within an agency doesn't mean you don't have to be creating that work in some capacity to show an interest in that. And that's something that you can be creating. So it's good that
it's
you're
really, it's well. Really important. It's super important. And in fact, that work that I've done and self-funded often on the weekends has been the work that shaped my career and got me my jobs. Like when I did my interview at Nike, it's horrible. They make you sit in this big room and you have a big telly and you have to present yourself, your life to this like panel of people who are like silent. Terrifying, but the work that I showed was all personal work because it was about showing the type of work that aligned with your values and your belief system. And that work is the work that I've made year after year on the weekends, in the summers, and so super important. Also the same at Refinery 29, the founder of Refinery 29, Piera, she only wanted to see my personal work. So it's super important to make that work because it truly reflects you.
Yeah, definitely. And would you say when you started out in your career, you just worked loads of internships on the side as well to build up your experience?
Yeah. By the time I went for like my internship at MNC Saatchi, I had already done quite a lot of internships. So by the age of like 14, I was quite clear that I needed to start identifying what I didn't want to do. Because at first I was like, I want to be a journalist. I want to be a fashion writer. I want to work for Vogue and I want to do, you know, I had all these like things of things. You know, these ideas of things I thought I wanted to do. And then upon having like an internship in journalism or internships in fashion PR, I did loads of internships, just a week or two. I did an internship at a modeling agency. I tried it all to try and see which bit I liked. And it was really disheartening at first because every sort of summer or Easter, I would kind of do these week internships and think, oh, that's not what I thought. That's not it, you know? Yeah. And then I was lucky enough to be on set one day through an internship, bringing the coffees for sure. And I remember seeing the all these different roles and thinking, oh, there's this incredible woman. I forget her name, but she was wearing these like fabulous boots and she had like this long hair and she was like bossing everyone around and she had the vision for what we were doing. And I was like, I want to be that woman.
Yeah.
She's amazing. And I obviously then realized she was the art director. And so I kind of identified, oh, there's this role out there. I just need to find a way to get there now.
Yeah. And do you have a distinct style yourself or do you like to keep it broad?
I think there's like two layers to that. I probably have a distinct style, like narratively and tonally. I always tend to gravitate towards the same sort of things. Like my beliefs really lie in like advancing the conversation around gender equity, around using like creativity and food and art as a place to have dialogue around identity. Those are things that are interesting to me. So generally speaking, I will gravitate towards those things. I think tonally, I'm quite a binary person. I get criticized for this a lot actually by everyone in my life. I'm very like black and white. Like it's either it is or it isn't. And I think that is actually a bit of a demon for me because I need to embrace the messy or the gray. But it's also like a big part of how I operate in my concepting and in my work. I'm very like extreme. It either is that color or it isn't. And it either says that or it doesn't. And I think in branding, that kind of confidence and assertiveness actually tonally and visually has helped me a lot because I really know what I like and what I don't and what is kind of the visual aesthetic of my own personal brand and the things that I like to put out on my side hustles. In work, I'm totally different. So at Refinery, I'm generally like pretty gothy and at Refinery, it's like rainbows. Refinery aesthetically and tonally is about rainbows. And so it was kind of like interesting for me to have to like bend to that design, but narratively and conceptually, it's all about like inclusion and women and feeling seen and heard. And so that was easy. That felt like breathing. But I definitely have a certain set of like aesthetic like principles that I gravitate towards, but my job is to not have those, you know, at Nike, and I try and be open.
Where do you source inspiration from for your work?
Lots of places, actually. I read this really cool book a few years ago about like how to stay fresh creatively, you should almost avoid the things that you like. So what I try and do is not go on like the same, you know, blogs or the same like websites or read the same kinds of books. I'll try and like mix it up constantly in an attempt to keep my, I don't know, like my frame of mind and my like perspective fresh. I also am like, I don't want to ever have that like, you know, built in. I mean, obviously we all carry around bias when we're creating, but I'm very aware of the like responsibility I have as a storyteller and the, you know, the reach I have in my jobs, you know, a massive brand like Nike and even previously at Refinery. And I think just thinking about like ensuring that I'm constantly acknowledging new perspectives, I think that's like really important to keep creative fresh. So yeah, I don't know. I listen to all sorts of podcasts. I read a lot. I push myself to experience things that I wouldn't necessarily gravitate towards naturally. So yeah, I think that's been a really good space for me. So like, even for example, in New York, I would have always gone to like gallery shows. There's certain shops I would have gone to, restaurants that make me feel excited because they have like a beautiful menu and like lighting design's great. And there are spaces I naturally gravitate towards and seek comfort in, and I recharge. But in Portland, you know, I'm a city girl for sure, but moving to Portland, which is like the most majestic nature, has been really good for me to like spend my weekends camping or hiking and things that don't naturally appeal to me. I found a lot of creative fuel in kind of recontextualizing myself, and then in those spaces I'll like journal or I'll come up with ideas because I have headspace too. So I would just say like seek out things that aren't obviously interesting to you and you'll find different sides of yourself, you know.
Yeah, that's really good advice. Which projects have you produced that you're particularly proud of?
That's really hard. I feel like I'm quite critical. So everything that's been, I'm like, now what are we doing next? I'm very like future facing.
Yeah.
I'm really proud of my recent project. That still feels, although even though I just did it a month ago, I'm like, things I would change. But yeah, I'm really proud of my recent project, which was like a self-published like zine called Eat Bitter, which is just a personal project, kind of like a recipe book, but also short stories. And I'm proud of how it came together, but I'm mostly proud of the journey that I went on creating it. So I think I mentioned like I'm quite controlling, binary. I like things a certain way. And Eat Bitter was really a place for me to kind of test being a little more kind to myself and letting things ebb and flow and flex and not necessarily be on time, or, you know, the deadline was set by me. And so I was able to like flex and like change it, which was really good learning for me to be a bit kinder to myself and realize that when you let something marinate for a bit, it actually can get better. Because in fact, when I first started doing Eat Bitter about a year ago, it was just a recipe zine about like my family's recipes and my identity. I'm half Chinese and Hakka. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like I grew up in Wales, but eating all this food, and Hakka is a really interesting group of people like that were kind of like historically displaced. And so it felt like that was something I could really relate to, being a half Chinese, Welsh, Brit in America. Felt like there was a lot there to unpack. But at first it was kind of just innocently this cute little self-indulgent zine that I was going to print like 100 of and then like quietly give to my family. But then, you know, I was going to put it out for Chinese New Year, but I was running late and it was really tough for me to like admit to myself I couldn't do it in time, because I'm very hard on myself. But what happened was, obviously this year transpired, so much happened in the world, and especially in America, you know, seeing like increased xenophobia towards the Asian community because of COVID. And I suddenly realized it grew this much sharper cultural significance that I wasn't expecting. And so through leaving it and giving it time to breathe, I realized that actually it could be something much bigger than I originally imagined. So that was a good lesson.
And how did you find the time to fit in your side hustle?
I'm quite regimented. So I'll get up early. I'll do an hour before work, and I'll work most Sundays. I wouldn't encourage that for everyone. I feel like that's, I don't know, it kind of depends what kind of person you are. It depends if you get a lot of energy from doing it. Like if you feel like you're pushing through and you're trying to make it through the week and, you know, make it through doing some work on your personal project, then I would stop and try and seek the like truth in what you're doing and why you want to do it. And then actually it will fuel you and you'll find time. You'll feel like time is suddenly stretched and you want to spend your Sunday doing it. And I had a few months of struggling to work on Eat Bitter. I started not liking it, didn't like the idea, didn't like the design system. I'd made it look shit. And I was just like, no, I don't like it anymore. I've moved on from that. And a couple of weeks went by and then I kind of made a pot of tea and like lit a candle and my husband went out somewhere and I had the house to myself and I was just like, okay, I'm going to try again. And I actually ended up sitting there for like 10 hours and was just like absorbed in it and got a lot of energy from it. I think that's the thing we got to recognize as creators. We often like push through like side hustles, even that word sounds tiring. And I don't think they should be. They should be very fueling. It should be that you do this side project, I'm going to rebrand it, and you feel like you get energy from it. You feel like you're your truest creative self in that. And then when you go into your day job, you feel like you have energy because you worked on it. It's almost like we need to like switch that balance, because otherwise you're trying to squeeze it in around everything and you'll burn out. I've been there, like coming home at 9 p.m. from my job in New York, trying to sit down and do a personal project. It's like rough, you know? No good work happens then. You just feel like shit.
Yeah. I'm a big advocate for side hustles because I was president juror of this year's side hustle category for DNAD. And so I've always loved them. And I really like the term passion project.
That's good, yeah.
Between that, because they can be something that reinvigorates you. And if you're not as fulfilled from your day job that's paying the bills, a passion project can be a way to really use your creativity to inject that love back into the work you're creating, really.
I think that's a really good point, because actually, I mean, I never take a job unless I feel like I get butterflies about the idea of showing up. But obviously, there are like different challenges that come with each role. And so it was really important for me to identify the thing in this specific role that I have that I wanted to exercise on the weekends, something that I needed to do. Like at Refinery, my like mission-driven like cup was very full. I was like working on the Women's March, I was working on stuff to do with the pay gap and ageism, and I was so full, I didn't need to do that on the weekends. Whereas when I was working in advertising agencies previously on, you know, anything from banks to airlines, all of it, I, on the weekends, I co-founded an initiative with Rape Crisis UK around clothing and consent. And that project was really important to me. I was clearly seeking out something that made me feel something more than what I had going on in my day-to-day job in agency life. So I think it's important to identify what is that piece of your creative self that you feel like you're missing or you're distant from because of what you do every day, and then identify that and have that be your side hustle. Because I think often people struggle to identify what is that thing I should put time into. And I have that too. I'll test a few. I have like 10 side hustles, and then I'll be like, well, those are the two that are really kind of really relevant, or they keep coming up, or I'll be out, you know, walking my dog and I'll write in my phone notes an idea. And that's like, that's obviously the one that's rising to the top, you know?
Yeah, and I'm often asked by creatives, how do they know how they should pick a side hustle? What would your advice be about that?
I would say, I don't know, I'm unusually formulaic for a creative brain. I like to write a lot of lists. So I feel like my advice always centers around that. I just think I like to clarify my thoughts. And so I would probably write down like the two things. I would write down a list of all the things that you like hate and you want to like punch that are like enemies to you. Because I feel like those like extreme reactions to things often promote really interesting solutions creatively. So I'd write all these things that you hate. I have a list actually ongoing in my pad right now next to me. And then I would also write a list of all the things that make you feel good, that give you energy. I know I've talked a lot about that as well, but I do think energy exchange is really important in everything, all our relationships with people, but in our creative work, knowing that you're going to show up 7 a.m. on a Sunday while your friends might be going out or whatever, and you want to be there, truly, that is the only place for you. So being able to show up for something like that, you need to like truly care about it. And it can feel random. So I think sometimes people are like, oh, I need to like, you know, I need to do something that feels really serious or like is like exceptional design or like leans into something that's happening in culture. Like there's so many pressures for our side hustles to feel super relevant. But I think if you build it and it's great, they will come. So I like my recipe zine's quite random. Like it's a printed thing. It's about food. It's about my childhood memories. Like that's not really about anyone apart from myself. And yet it, you know, through conviction and like pulling it together exactly how I wanted it. I've designed it. I couldn't give a shit if no one reads it. I love how it looks. It represents me. I feel excited to have it on my shelf. And that's all that matters, I think. And when you make from a place like that, I think people gravitate towards that. So headline is basically just only do something that only you can do. Be very true to what you're interested in. Because if you try and mimic things that you think people are doing right now as side hustles, it won't be good. It won't show up well, and you'll regret the time you spent on it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the advice I always give is, what can you not stop talking about after a few drinks? You know, like in the pub, and you're just ranting about it. And that's either because you love it so much or it really pisses you off. And you've got
to have a function,
like you say. And you've got to want it enough to give up time with friends or doing other things that can distract you. So you also became a creative director at age 30 at Refinery. How did you make that happen?
Yeah, I feel like, I don't know, the creative director title is like, so it doesn't mean anything anymore. I feel like it used to mean a lot. To me, it meant you are like older white man in a really shiny office, you're scary, and on a Friday, you will tell me if I'm allowed to come back on the Monday, and you'll pay me like 70 quid a week for my internship. I just feel like those days are gone. Like, that's this idea of like the king that runs the whole show creatively and dictates to everyone, and everyone sits there and executes on their vision, that's gone, that's over. And so I think I hopefully represent a shift in that thinking, that it's the person who's right for the job, the person who has a vision, knows how to manage like a big group of people and galvanize them behind that vision. That's all that matters. It doesn't matter who you are. And so that was me, and I was sure it was me. I went for that job at Refinery. I was already writing for Refinery as a contributing style writer on the side hustle while working at Anomaly. And it was really fun. I loved Anomaly. It's such a cool ad agency. The best kind of ad agency, in that they're not one. Like, all the culture, all the like security, all the innovation, and you get to just kind of like come up with ideas, and like people will truly support great creativity in that space, which is very rare. So all to say, I didn't want to leave. I was really happy there. I was also partnered up with my husband, and we were making really fun work on like Converse, and yeah, it was great. But I got approached to go and interview for this job at Refinery. And honestly, guys, when I was told, oh, it's a creative director role, I was like, I don't know about that. What does that mean? Because in my mind, actually, that's alarm bells of like, there's a certain set of like conventions or like expectations or stereotypes around that role that I think are a bit old school and a bit like kind of redundant. And so I'm very much like trying to reclaim that now, because I feel like creative directors today should be like integrated hybrid thinkers, you know, people who are able to like lead a load of excellent craft specialists, but aren't necessarily nerdy about typography. Because I feel like in the old days, a lot of the people that were creative directors had often come up through 20 years of design or copy or whatever, and so had a real depth of craft and understanding of one specific thing. But to be a creative director, you don't have to be brilliant at one thing. You kind of have to be a little bit good at everything, and have enough vision to make everyone feel like they want to follow that and get behind it and inspire people. So you're really more of a people leader than anything else, I think. And so that, I think, is the new definition of the creative director. And I think why I got my role at Refinery, because I went into that interview and was just like, I've managed small teams. But one thing I do know is mission-driven marketing. I know how to speak to clients. I know how to make people believe and feel inspired. Here's my personal work again. Here's like the work that I've done with rape crisis charities. Here's a video I did for Elle magazine in my spare time. Like, here's all these things that I do because I like viscerally care and show up for these things. Do you think that I can inspire this like massive team of like epically talented women? And the answer was yes. And I honestly, the first couple of months, imposter syndrome was fucking rife. I felt so nervous because I knew that I could do it, but I look quite young. Turned 32 yesterday. I look quite young, and you know, my leadership style is very like vulnerable. Like, I like to say if I don't know or be imperfect, and I don't like bossing people around. I kind of want to, if people love it and they feel it and they want to work on it, you'll get great work. So I'd rather be inspiring every day than like bossy. So I have a very different style. And so I struggled for a few months to find my flow, and then eventually ended up making some amazing work and learning a lot. So I'm really happy and lucky I got that opportunity. Yeah.
And are there any, what creative mistakes have you made in the past that you can, an example you can think of, and how did you overcome it as well? Because sometimes they can start off as mistakes, but end up being these brilliant things that happen in some way. Or sometimes they're just royal fuck ups that can't be said.
I've made some mistakes. I've made a lot of mistakes. I think my biggest lesson from this industry and from working in it is, like, through so much blind conviction sometimes, I'm so absolute and specific about running towards what I want. I think sometimes I lose sight of like the point and of what's actually happening in the moment. Lesson for my entire life. But specifically when I was working in advertising at the beginning, I was in advertising for quite a few years, and I feel like I kind of lost my way. I started to like really like wear qualities of people around me to try and fit in and like make sense of what I was in that space. Often a minority in every sense, in that I was a woman of color without a real craft specialism, kind of opinionated and gobby, but wasn't quite sure where to direct it. And so I really tried on a few hats during that time, and maybe it needed to happen. But I do think that creatives, it's an inherently ego-driven choice we've made, right, to work in this industry. The creative output is you. And I think, therefore, it's super complex, and the spaces in which we operate are really complex, because we're all there with our feelings and our opinions, showing up for our craft. We made a decision to try and earn money from being creative. And I think those that kind of like ego soup is like, it's a tough place to be. And I lost myself for a little, started masquerading a lot of like very stern male qualities to try and like show up and be very confident. And I think my work suffered for it. Like, I kind of made bullshitty work that didn't really align with my values. I was just trying to impress whomever was in that golden glass office. And I realized that that's when it breaks. If the system breaks, when you're creating against someone else's vision that you don't really believe in or you don't align with, versus going to that person and saying, I know how we should show up for this. This is my vision. This is what I want to get behind. And I've realized that now. It was like a kind of eureka moment where I was like, oh, I need to have a set of values and beliefs that I show up for and bring to my work every day. And if that isn't what this person wants, or this agency wants, or this client wants, I probably shouldn't be here, because I'm not going to make great work then. And that became a really important filter for me then. You know, at Anomaly, I was able to make much more mission-driven work, and then Refinery, super mission-driven. And now I'm at the biggest brand in the world, arguably the biggest marketer for mission-driven work in the world. That's not by accident. You know, I followed what I was interested in with conviction, and that's why I've landed here. So yeah, I would say it's a really nasty lesson that maybe everyone has to learn, but like, I definitely wore a lot of hats, made some shit work, and then realized that I was actually not being myself and I needed to come out the end of that.
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes when you're like midway through your career, you become a bit of a chameleon, where you're trying to find your place, yeah, and you're trying to appease certain structures within that agency and just to survive. And then you get to a point where you're like, actually, it's all about you and your voice. A lot of these talks that I've run, Becky McCohen Banks at Vayner Media, she speaks about finding your voice in your home. And that's what sets you apart as a creative, and you've identified where you like to create work, and that's what you find more fulfilling. And then you just create the best work that you can because you're inspired.
And then people gravitate towards that. This is the thing. I think everybody is such a fight to be, to have your work seen and to be relevant. But the thing is, if you just quietly make something that fulfills what you're about, everyone, we're all gagging for authenticity. Everyone just literally gravitates towards anything that feels true, because there's so much facade out there. And I think that's been really interesting to watch with my zine. Is, you know, no one needs another recipe zine. That's not like relevant. But like, because I made it with so much blind intention of like what I want, and this is going to be absolutely, completely, authentically my story, I've noticed that people gravitating towards it because they want a little slice of something that's completely, fully, unadulteratedly real. And that is like a real lesson. I'm like, oh, well, next year, maybe I'll do something even more random. It kind of is like, sky's the limit then. It's just what makes you feel good.
Mm. Definitely. So anyone that's watching this that wants to get their hands on access to the zine, can they buy it or have you sold out?
You can still buy it. We're still operating in pre-order. So eatbitter.co, which we'll see the very fancy website that my husband kindly coded for me.
Amazing. So could you talk to us a bit more about the campaign that you created for Rape Crisis UK?
Yeah, so it was a really big turning point for me because I was working in agencies, but really seeking more of that mission-driven work and wasn't quite sure how to do it in those systems. You know, I was like, I kind of got there with loads of good intention and realized that, you know, one Getty image at a time wasn't going to get me there. And so I, myself and a group of friends who worked in the same industry, a copywriter and a book editor and an illustrator and a designer, we kind of all had similar set of skills, worked in the same industry, and we knew we wanted to make something together, and we knew we wanted to do something around like visual culture and consent. And so actually we put together a pitch for what we wanted this campaign to be. It was called This Doesn't Mean Yes, basically alluding to the fact that like a red lip or a short skirt or a heel cannot give consent, like clothing and style choices cannot speak. And it was in response to an ad that had come out. I don't know if you guys remember this, but it was a very contentious ad at the time, about 10 years ago now, to be fair. But the police, put out an ad saying, you know, watch out for your friends. It's your responsibility to keep an eye on your friends. And I just remember us having this like guttural reaction of like, wait, so we all got, it's on us. we've suddenly got all this responsibility to look after each other. Why is this ad not about going after the person who's committing this heinous crime? Why is it suddenly about all of us, you know, looking after each other and that kind of like victim shaming, basically? So that was the reason that we made it. We then were like, well, we want to make it with someone. We want this attention and this funding to go somewhere. So we approached Rape Crisis UK, cold called, and was just like, we're a group of creatives in the industry. We have an idea. We have a campaign. We want nothing from you. We are going to like self-fund it. I think we all put in like a couple of hundred quid that we didn't have. We're going to self-fund it. We're going to do this photo shoot. We're going to get loads of press. We were just like, please work with us on it. And so the founder of Rape Crisis UK was like, okay, I'll meet with you. You seem very enthusiastic, so I'll meet with you. I remember going to meet her wearing these fabulous new clogs that I was really excited about, but they rubbed my feet like really badly. And so I like hobbled in like bleeding feet. And I was just like, look, we want to create this work. We want to do it. We just want to do it for free. We want your support. That's it. And we put together the shoot. We decided to commission Peru, who's a fashion photographer in the UK, very consciously. I've always been very nerdy about like the ethics and the gaze and commissioning and the you know, bias. And that's always been like an area I'm super fascinated by. And Peru for me is actually a male white fashion photographer who has historically objectified women in his imagery, sexualized them. And, you know, that's been something that he's done with his fashion photography. I found that fascinating to then use his lens and his gaze to empower these women, because we then went in Shoreditch Saturday night and we just popped up a shoot and like a seamless, and we were basically like, anybody that was walking past, like, sign a form, and if you want to be shot for this campaign, then go for it. And hundreds of women showed up, like all on their way out, and they were just like, this is amazing, like all of them in front of the camera, just like really owning their power. It was really beautiful to see. We got some incredible images, and I thought it was really fascinating that he wanted to work with us. And then loads of press showed up, and it ended up doing really well and getting really, really good, like, global press. Zooey Deschanel shared it, which was a personal highlight for me. It was beautiful because, you know, we had, like, victims reach out saying, your campaign made me feel like I could get dressed today. And that's something that I've every morning considered. And this campaign has made me suddenly feel like I can get dressed. And it was like, that was probably the most significant piece of feedback for us, was hearing from victims. And then Rape Crisis UK saying that it was the most successful campaign they've ever run and they didn't spend a penny. So yeah, it was amazing.
That is incredible. I love that story. And it's important for creatives to know that they can approach like charities like Matt Dunn, that I had as another industry leader. He did a project where he put graffiti condoms on penises for the NHS, and he did that, and that went viral, and that then got him jobs at some dream agencies. Mm-hmm. And you can do that actually as a create small creative team, band together and approach charities and offer that, and that's a really good story from the success of you doing that. So how did you land your job at Nike?
So I was working as creative director at Refinery. Mm-hmm. I have a few mentors, so people that I meet along the way who I find really inspiring. There's specifically one, a guy called Kevin Lyons at Anomaly, who's one of these new creative directors. He's like this hybrid, just storyteller. He's just a very inspiring human being, and he just doesn't care about like the system. He doesn't care about like, he's very like infiltrate from within. He follows his own path. And I found him so inspiring when I met him at Anomaly. It kind of was like, I got there, felt really displaced. And again, another hybrid role where I had to prove myself to all these epically talented designers and copywriters. And I met Kevin and was just like, oh, you're like me. You are like a storyteller and you like care about culture and trends. And it was just like a real aha moment. So meeting him was really defining for me. And since then we've stayed in touch and he's always helped guide me on my way. So, you know, if I got an offer at a Refinery or something happened, or I needed to negotiate a salary, or I wasn't sure if I was going to take on a personal project, something like that, I text him and be like, help me. So he's great. And he basically just messaged me and was just like, oh, there's something going, you should like have a chat with them. So I think in fact he recommended me to the person who was hiring. They reached out and said, would you be interested? And to be honest, I was a bit like, I've always wanted to work for Nike. It's a mission driven brand, an exceptional brand. But I was unsure about leaving New York, and I was super happy at Refinery. There's a pattern here, right? I was really happy at Anomaly, really happy at Refinery, because I make very conscious moves to work for people where our beliefs align. And so it's really hard to then leave, because you really feel like you've joined a family. And so, yeah, I struggled to leave Refinery, but upon visiting Portland, they flew us out here for a weekend just to see it. And it's amazing. I realized that actually in New York, I was seeking nature and peace, and I didn't have time for my personal projects because I felt super overwhelmed by the city. I've been there a couple of years as well. I was getting a little bit burnt out. And so, yeah, I just fancied a change of pace, basically. And so I came and did my interview, terrifying, which I mentioned earlier, on the campus. And yeah, presented all of my work. And originally I was coming for a role in the editorial department, but quickly shifted around. That's the cool thing about Nike, actually. You get to like experience lots of different types of creative output because it's massive. And yeah, I'm really enjoying it so far. It's only been a year, and obviously I've spent most of it in this office. But it's an amazing group of people, some of the most talented people I've ever worked with, actually.
Yeah, that's so cool. And so how have you found, obviously, this whole experience of COVID has affected all of us? Do you think that through lockdown and a lot of people doing a lot more soul searching, that it's going to affect consumer mindsets in some way?
Oh yeah, for sure. I think we're in a place now where, I mean, for me, there's like so many layers of it this year being in America. You know, you have like COVID, and then like obviously we just come out at the end of like wildfires, and like Portland is still very much a place of a lot of unrest with a lot of the like protests, and then we have the election coming up. It's like a lot going on, and I think consumers are now in a place where, and this is cool, it's kind of a reckoning. Like there's no bullshit now. Like what, like let's get down to like the essence of what we're trying to do, and if that is to sell something, let's just fucking say that. Because the more we try and coat it in inspiration of like, you know, a millennial dancing in the sunset, or like this is mission driven, it's a yogurt, you know, like we need to be a lot more like real about what we're actually saying. And if something is much more transactionally a product drop, or if this is something that is about like sparking a cultural movement, and that, you know, we need to be interrogating when and if a brand should be doing that. You know, I think brands can be vehicles for good. That's why I work for Nike, like arguably, in my opinion, the best brand in the world that's showing up culturally and politically in an interesting way that contributes value. But we need to be interrogating when that's necessary. and when that's our role, and when we should be doing it with integrity, and when we're just fucking selling product. Like, that needs to also be like just much more like straight up. There's this awkward blur right now where everything's trying to be super authentic, politically engaged, inspiring, and then also make me buy something. And I think consumers are starting to get to a point where we're also fatigued from spending so much time online more than ever because we're trapped at home and that's the only way to like get out. I think that it's about essentialism, being concise, and about being really considered about when you show up. Because I think a year ago I would have said brands need to show up every day and have a daily dialogue with the consumer, blah, blah, blah. And I feel like that was true, but we're now in a place of showing up. It's like, if you've got nothing to say, don't speak kind of thing.
Yeah,
would be my advice. Because I think the consumers are in a place now of like, I've got a lot more going on. So unless you've got something relevant or useful, then I don't want to know, which I agree with. I feel like that too.
Well, it's like the table of the hierarchy of needs. And there's a lot of people at the moment that are literally base level of, I don't know if I'm going to lose my job and not be able to pay my mortgage and my bills. And it's hard for brands to be like, hey, like, as you say, an inspirational yogurt pot of a new flavor. And people are like, what the hell? Like, I'm so mentally loaded right now and very emotional. Stop selling that to me. I don't think people have the tolerance for it.
The brands that I think have been the most interesting and successful are the ones that have shown up in this framework of branded utility. So like, think about like Sweetgreen providing like free lunches to anybody who's an essential worker. Smart, quiet and smart and clever. You know, I think that's a really nice example of a brand showing up with its beliefs, showing the type of brand that it wants to be and who it wants to be aligning with quietly. They didn't need to capture a load of BTS of everyone like dishing out Caesar salads to nurses. It was just like a little bit more classy. And yep. I think that's how it's going to have to be now, which is cool because we're kind of forcing brands, agencies, whomever, to speak with a lot more thought and show up a little bit more thoughtfully. And I think this branded utility movement, which has been going for years, is suddenly going to become a lot more important because actually, do we need another inspirational 60-second YouTube cut? You know, no, probably not.
Yeah.
No one's going to watch.
Yeah, I agree. It'd be interesting to see what this next phase is going to be like now the pause button's been pressed and we've all had a chance to really reflect and build what people keep referring to as the new normal. But what's normal? You know, everyone keeps asking as well.
Yeah. You know, something I've been thinking a lot about recently is the fact that like we've kind of broken this 9-to-5 system, this kind of time construct that was defining us. And like my husband and I were chatting about this idea of like being very like input driven, like a time card. And it's almost like Industrial Revolution hangover where we're all like, I, you know, clock in, do my emails, be really present on Slack and then clock out. Whereas I think we're shifting now to a place where it's not about the hours you clock in. It's not about that time input. It's about like output. And if you can create something of meaning and you have an output, that's how you're going to be defined in the new way of working and in this new construct that we're going to call the 9-to-5. So yeah, I'm really interested by that. I think it's about like your output versus the time you put into it.
Yeah, I agree. How did you get your mentor?
That's a good question. So I think I'll often just like, I don't feel like you don't want to ask like straight up because it feels a bit intense, but I kind of like caught them. So like my mentor, Kevin, he very naturally became somebody who I went to for advice. And then he started becoming somebody who I would get a coffee with even when I left Anomaly. So we worked together first. That was easier because we had that like connection in that we were in the same space. And then I just made sure to keep up that like communication. We don't have like a formal monthly check-in like I know some people have with their mentors. I really like to keep a bit more chilled. I just know he's there and he's always got my back. But I do know that some people, I mentor other people, and I do know that some people like to keep it a little more like organized. And so I think there's nothing wrong with like seeking out someone and being like, hey, I want to hear from you. Like, I'm inspired by your work. I imagine you're really busy, but if you do have any like time where you are willing to like mentor someone, I would love for that to be me. And it can be like, you know, a quarterly, you know, half an hour phone call, or can I just email you when I'm unsure about a job move? And I think I do that for a couple of people, and it's really fulfilling to like pay it forward, because a lot of people helped me. And so yeah, I would say if you were in a space at work, or you know, with, you know, like a side hustle or like a community you're part of, and you see someone that you think your energy and your strength and your vision for your career is what I want, and they don't have to be in the same industry, and they also notably don't have to be older than you or more experienced than you. I have a lot of peer mentors who I will call upon and say, I know that you're like mid-30s like me, that you've got this big job and you may be thinking about making this move or this move. Like, what would you do in this situation? Or how much money are you earning right now? Should I be earning more? Like, did I do good? Like, what is your bonus? Like, you know, you need to like have people you can have really candid conversations with. So I think it's important to seek out mentors at every level.
Yeah, definitely. As a designer who wants to make a difference in the world, how important do you think location is? Do you think people really need to be in big cities like London, New York, Portland to really create changes?
No, I don't think so. I love that you threw Portland there as a big city. That was really nice. No, I don't think so at all. I think that every link is created equal. It doesn't matter where you make it from, just like create. In fact, you're probably at an advantage, because living in London and New York, those places are like super expensive. And actually, I actually felt at first super inspired by living in New York, and then suddenly saturated by everyone's overwhelming talent and output and so much going on. I kind of got lost and was like, what do I like again? It's like going into Topshop, not to Circus. You're like, do I want tassels? Like, you suddenly feel like you're not sure about who you are and what your taste is. New York did that to me, where I was like, I feel a bit stressed. So I think having that forced distance, living somewhere different that isn't one of those big cities, gives you that benefit. You have the headspace of like going and doing a day trip and having like that, those experiences, going to the galleries or seeing those spaces, and then returning and being like, right, with clarity now and objectivity, what do I want to create? So yeah, massively do not think you need to be in a city to create change at all. Especially now with like, everyone is literally online 24/7, so.
Yeah, I agree. Because I launched Industry Leaders when I was locked in my mum's spare room in a village with no access. And actually, you can just access so much online nowadays at this moment in time for inspiration. How have you dealt with imposter syndrome, and do you still suffer from it?
Yeah, I have struggled from it a lot. And I know I think it's interesting that I am like, naturally quite confident and assertive, and yet I do suffer from, I think, quite bad imposter syndrome. I don't know if they come hand in hand maybe, but I've struggled from it pretty much every like job I've felt like that. And it may be that I always set myself like big goals, and so then when I run towards them, when I get to it and I have to actually like show up and perform, I'm suddenly like, shit. But the way I've dealt with it in a couple of ways, there's a specific book I actually found super helpful called The War of Art, which by Stephen Pressfield. It's a really short, easy to read book. There's a construct in there that he describes. It's called the resistance. And I found that super interesting as a notion, this idea that we all have within us this resistance. And actually it's our job to show up for ourselves and to kind of like push away that this like imposter syndrome is basically. And I found a lot of the things that he talked about really helpful as like tangible things. I think considering the spaces in which you feel imposter syndrome the most, and then identifying in those spaces evangelists. So like, I don't know if you guys have heard about like shine theory, this idea that the women in the White House would like, basically they had this pact where if a woman said something or came up with an idea, another woman would shine light on her and say, oh, great idea, Nikki. Good idea, Nikki. I really like that idea, Nikki. Make sure they stamp their name on it. And that shine theory, the idea of showing up for each other in those spaces that are vulnerable, I thought was super interesting. And so that's actually one of the ways in which I find practically I can move through imposter syndrome is quickly in a new job or in a space, finding an evangelist or two or three, having one-on-ones with them, gaining that like connection with them, explaining my vision, what I'm about, really like, because I think imposter syndrome often comes from a place of wanting to like kind of tell everyone like, oh no, I am good. I promise I'm meant to be here. And that proving yourself, I think, is like so tiring. And so I found it great when I started at Nike, major imposter syndrome. But quickly got like two or three people who were my like internal evangelists and was like, you know, we went for lunch. I had to put myself out there because I'm a little bit of a like confident but somewhat introvert. I would much rather be on my own to recharge. And so I struggled to be like, let's go for lunch, just the two of us. And sit there and let me kind of tell you all about me. And I think once you gain those connections, suddenly in those spaces where you felt really vulnerable, you know you can lock eyes with someone who you know knows you, knows your beliefs, knows what you're there for and how to show up for you. And that's helped me a lot, having that support system. But not just expecting it to be there, consciously building it, that's really important. And then I think also my third thing on imposter syndrome, I feel like this imposter syndrome is such a fascinating concept. So my third thing on it would be journaling when something happens, when an interaction happens, so you can unpack it. So for example, when I first started at Nike, I had to pitch a little bit, like, you know, and I'm very confident pitching, like at Refinery, I would pitch a room of 50 people. No worries, you know? And suddenly at Nike, I was struggling to speak without getting like the dry mouth thing in front of like four or five people. And I realized it was because, I felt like those people didn't know me and didn't have a connection to me and didn't know where I was operating from. They were just kind of like dismissing me as somebody, you know, oh, who's this new girl? Because Nike as well, like there's so many people constantly joining. And so I realized when I left those interactions, journaling in my phone or in my notebook, why did I feel that way? What was that about? And, you know, how can I avoid that in the future? And so I started doing things like taking people who I knew were going to be in big meetings like that for coffees in the morning. So they didn't feel scary. Like, oh, hi, person. I know I'm going to be in a big meeting with you later. Like, it's nice. I just wanted to introduce myself before we have that work session later. And then when I get in there, I don't feel like unknown. I felt like I'd made a connection. So, yeah, there are a couple of things that you can do. Those are three things that I've done. I would highly recommend that book.
I think in so many people, I have heard about that book. It is really good. So many people suffer with imposter syndrome more than you'd think of. I suffer with it from time to time as well, and people wouldn't always believe that. And it's just, you just act like you're owning it and that you're confident, but actually nobody knows what's going on inside with somebody with their own thoughts compared to what they're projecting. And they're saying, you know, things like, don't talk yourself out of the room that you've been invited to with imposter syndrome, and things like, there are real imposters out there. And if you are actually feeling like you are the imposter, then it probably isn't you.
Oh my God, that's so true. That's such a truth of like, your awareness of it, therefore means you're not it. Yeah. Like aware of it. I love that. I think it's super important to be really prepped as well. Like I find that I feel more calm when I over prepare. So like, even if going into what might seem like a very simple meeting or a simple space or a call, I will write notes just of things that I will say, even things of like talking points to bring up if I feel like it feels awkward, just so I have that padding for myself.
Yeah.
I think it's important to prep personally.
Yeah, definitely. Prep is number one, the key way to manage nerves or feeling like an imposter in any situation. Mm-hmm. Lydia, I'm going to let you go because I know you're super busy, but I really appreciate you sharing your morning with us, especially today after your birthday. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you everyone that's tuned in. Really great talk. Thanks again, Lydia.
Thank you so much. I had a really nice time. Thanks, guys.
Right. Have a good day. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.